it's unlikely that when Friedrich Nietzsche said, "What doesn't kill us makes us stronger," that he was thinking of inherited diseases. Yet, as Dr. Sharon Moalem points out in Survival of the Sickest, many hereditary health problems that threaten people's lives today, like diabetes and high blood pressure, were genetic adaptations to protect and extend the lives of our ancestors. His book, which was written with Jonathan Prince, is published by William Morrow, and I'm very pleased that it brings Dr. Sharon Moalem to my show today. Hello.
Hello.
Obviously, your title, Survival of the Sickest, is a play on Charles Darwin's Survival of the Fittest. At first glance, your title seems to contradict Darwin's theory of evolution.
Right. It actually plays in perfectly and supports it, because it's all about natural selection. And it's evolution's way of coming up with a compromise that led our ancestors to survive some pretty nasty plagues and pretty nasty climate changes.
The one that is usually cited when we talk about this is sickle cell anemia.
Sure. So sickle cell is always considered to be the exception to provide protection against malaria. But what I'm arguing in Survival of the Sick is that it's not the exception, it's actually the rule, that all common diseases that are genetic actually arose to protect us from usually something infectious or a severe climate change.
So diabetes, Alzheimer's, you say?
Even high cholesterol.
Tay-Sachs?
Even Tay-Sachs.
So is every inherited trait, even those that at first glance seem to be hurting rather than helping us, likely to have a positive aspect to it as well?
Well, it all has to do with numbers. If the diseases are common, then, of course, natural selection, evolution must be or through evolution, there must be some type of benefit. If it's a very rare disorder, then it's, of course, a lot less likely.
And I guess that means that every genetic black cloud will have a silver lining that scientists can discover if they're willing to go back far enough into history to find it.
Exactly. And there's actually a very good example of that. It always intrigued me that for some reason, Northern Europeans are very susceptible to type 1, which is called juvenile diabetes. That's the insulin dependent, where usually children get it. And it never really made any sense to me, because essentially it's knocking off kids, and kids aren't going on to produce other children. So I thought, you know, could this be protective? And through my research, I found that there's a frog. His name's a wood frog. The Latin name is Rana sylvatica. And the wood frog has this amazing ability to survive the cold. And it manages the cold by getting diabetes. And it does this every winter. And what it does is, winter approaches and it feels the cold, its sugar levels spike, maybe 30 times as high. And it could actually, it uses that to freeze solid.
So we can trace that back in Scandinavia to the Ice Age, 13,000 years ago or so?
Yeah, it's about 14,000. It's called the Younger Dryas. And, you know, there was that movie where New York freezes over. It didn't happen that suddenly, but we're talking in at least a decade, temperatures plummeted, maybe 30 degrees.
And so people who had diabetes actually were likely to survive when others were not.
Exactly. And it doesn't mean that they had to have full-blown diabetes. They might just have had spiked sugars. And it is our body's natural defense system. Today's a very cold day here in New York. And on my walk over here, naturally my body will let my sugar levels rise a little bit higher, because it's essentially the slushy effect. And the slushy is not a solid block of ice, because there's so much sugar in it.
So why doesn't everybody in Scandinavia have diabetes?
It's a great question. I'm happy you asked me that. It has to do, of course, with the compromise. And since the compromise is pretty heavy, and over the past centuries, people have adapted by either living indoors with heat or clothing, the selection advantage, of course, starts to decrease.
Although Finland still has the highest rate in the world, and Sweden the second highest rate. Norway tied with the UK, another country that was very cold, for the third highest.
Right.
It's interesting that those are all countries where milk is drunk.
Right.
Whereas in other parts of the world, that is not the case. Any links there?
Or is that just coincidental? Well, no, it's not direct, but it's very interesting that you bring that up also, because most people in North America think that drinking milk into adulthood is the norm. But in fact, if, you know, you're sitting at home right now and you're sipping a latte or cappuccino, you may in fact be a mutant, because the majority of people in the world can't break down the sugars in milk into adulthood.
They're lactose intolerant.
Exactly. So if your ancestors used animals for their milk, then through natural selection, the people who could take advantage of that milk into adulthood survived.
I've heard that the milk provides us with vitamin D, which is less likely to be abundant in northern areas. So
right.
So that was another adaptation. Are we still in the midst of an evolutionary process?
Of course. Evolution never stops. And, you know, this is as recently as the awful Spanish influenza of 1918. People have realized, or they're thinking, that possibly so many people died that there was a selection factor there.
Well, what about the other way? Since there are all sorts of protections against cold, why wouldn't diabetes pretty much have disappeared as part of the evolutionary process in Scandinavia?
Well, that could also be a result, well, the reason that it decreased to such lower numbers. It could have possibly been much more common in the past.
You focus a lot of attention here on hemochromatosis, a genetic illness that causes people to retain too much iron. Now, I gather you have a personal reason to be interested in that.
Yes, I do. I actually suffer from this condition, and it's an amazing disorder where you can actually rust to death. So
rust to death?
You heard me right. So your body absorbs too much iron from the diet, and it builds up in certain organs, and it can cause everything from cancer to diabetes. And the treatment's very simple. It's just going and giving a blood donation.
Well, as I understand survival of the fittest, the condition has to be there before the problem arises, and then only those people who have it are immune. So do we have any idea why something like hemochromatosis would have predated the plague that you say it helped people survive in the 14th century?
So it's very interesting. That was the previous thought. There many researchers, including myself, are thinking that DNA has a built-in system of hypermutation. So there is something called jumping genes. They're called transposons and retrotransposons. And they were discovered first in corn. And when corn plants are stressed out, these genes start jumping, and they start essentially reshuffling the DNA.
So suddenly the whole population starts adjusting, and people who have a tendency to an illness like this might very well be the ones who would wind up getting it and then surviving.
Exactly.
Now, can you explain how that helped people survive the great plague that killed 25 million people in the 14th century?
Sure. So it's fascinating because when I first looked at it, it didn't make any sense to me, because the genes that that result in too much iron, one in three people of European descent may be carrying at least one of them, and that didn't make any sense to me. I didn't understand how, you know, 33% of the population could carry a mutation. And then I realized that possibly the iron is being hidden. And it turns out that almost everything on Earth needs iron to survive. And just for example, the Pacific is a crystal clear blue, and the Atlantic is green because the Atlantic is fertilized by the Sahara. And the Saharan dust is iron rich, and it lands in the ocean and essentially fertilizes it, and you get algae blooms. So everything on Earth needs iron. And it turns out that the plague organism needs iron as well. And people with this mutation, they have an ability to hide away iron.
So what is anemia? The result of people who have been hiding it away, or the people?
Great question. So there's two types of anemia. There's anemia where you're lacking red blood cells. That's usually the one that people refer to. But there's also anemia when you're lacking iron. And unfortunately, the medical terms are the same and different meanings. So there is something, though, called anemia of chronic disease. And the minute that any of us get ill or come down, even with some type of a cancer, our body hides away the iron because it doesn't want, if it's a cancer or a fungus or a bacteria, to grow. It hides away the iron. So you appear anemic. And unfortunately, most physicians today don't know. So if they have a cancer patient who's appearing anemic, they sometimes even prescribe iron to them, which actually might be feeding the cancer.
You say that the prevalence of the hemochromatosis gene may explain why bloodletting was one of the most popular procedures of the medical profession, particularly in the 18th and 19th centuries.
Right.
What does bloodletting do?
So bloodletting, our blood is red for the fact that there's iron. and when iron rusts, it turns a red color. So the iron is within hemoglobin, and that's what carries around the oxygen. And that's found in red blood cells. So if you're removing someone's blood, you're removing red blood cells. So essentially, you're removing the iron. So I myself have to donate blood once every 2 months to keep my iron levels in check.
You say that George Washington may have had hemochromatosis. What is the reasoning behind that assumption?
No, actually, in the book we talk about how George Washington and Abraham Lincoln possibly, because of the prescriptive bleeding of the time, that actually may have led to their earlier deaths.
He was bled four times in 24 hours.
Right, which is an incredible amount.
Dr. Sharon Moalem has written Survival of the Sickest. It's written with the help of Jonathan Prince and published by William Morrow. We will continue our conversation after this. My guest is Sharon Moalem, who has a PhD in human physiology and in the emerging fields of neurogenetics and evolutionary medicine. And he is the author of a new book with the help of Jonathan Prince called Survival of the Sickest. It is published by William Morrow. You've said that an ability to shed water was another reason that, getting back to the people with diabetes, to their survival. Why would diabetes lead to the shedding of water?
So the increased amount of sugar your body's trying to get rid of that it can't use. Unfortunately, without insulin, you can eat as much as you want. Your blood could be full of as much insulin as it can handle, but it doesn't get into the cells. So your body tries to get rid of it so it doesn't cause problems, and you end up passing a lot of urine.
Is that why we feel the urge to urinate in cold weather?
No, that's different. That response actually is really interesting. So the minute that you feel the cold, and now your body always fights to conserve its water, remember. But here, the minute the body feels any type of cold on the skin, it dumps pure water. And it does this to concentrate the blood, and which is to prevent freezing.
Doesn't evolution even explain why some... In fact, quite a few people of Asian descent have difficulty tolerating alcohol.
Yes, this is fascinating. So when people centuries ago, you know, started settling and living in towns, the first thing that they couldn't do was drink the water. The water supply usually got polluted. So different cultures and civilizations managed this in very different ways. In Asia, they boiled their water to disinfect it and made tea. And in Europe, there was a lot of fermentation going on, and the fermentation process does a lot of essential kind of sterilization. So there was a pressure to be able to consume alcohol because you were drinking diluted wine and beer all day long. And in Asia, since you were drinking tea, today 50% of Asians lack the gene that allows them to break down alcohol, and they get something called Asian flush. So if they have one or two drinks, their face gets really red and they appear drunk, but it's actually an allergic reaction.
What about Native Americans? Is that inherited through the Asian connection?
Exactly. So the Native Americans are today thought to be of Asian descent. And the unfortunate thing is that one thing, if you do have this gene, it does give you some type of resistance against alcoholism. But it seems that resistance is hard. It's very hard to find that amongst the Native population.
You also say that there's an allergy to fava beans that helps guard people against malaria. How many people eat fava beans?
Well, millions, believe it or not. So, and they think that there's up to about 400 million people who actually have this allergy, and there's at least a billion people who consume them.
You've included a controversial theory in your book about why African Americans are two times as likely to have high blood pressure as other Americans. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. So this all has to do with an awful time in history during the period of slavery, and it's called the Middle Passage. So the mortality and the death rate was so high on the ships coming over from Africa because many of the Africans that were brought over as slaves were not given rations of water and food. So you can imagine the immense pressure and dehydration that was happening in the ship's hold. So people who had the ability to hold on to their salt were the ones that didn't dehydrate as quickly. Yet today, if descendants of those individuals, if they retain a lot of salt, that results in high blood pressure.
You've called their survival unnatural selection. That's because that was forced upon them. It wasn't the same thing as living in an environment where your body is adjusting.
Sure. It was more intended as a play on words, but definitely. I mean, there's many instances where things that we've done medically have also now have been thought to push different kinds of selection.
So do we know for sure that the relatives, the distant relatives of African Americans still in Africa don't have problems with high blood pressure?
That's a great question. So when researchers went to Africa and started studying this blood pressure in general, they found that you don't see blood pressure at the same rate.
High cholesterol has also been found to be more of a problem for African Americans than for Caucasians. How does that work?
So this has to do with our complicated relationship with the sun. So our body essentially photosynthesizes. It puts out its cholesterol, and through a couple intermediaries, we end up with vitamin D. And vitamin D is essential for, of course, healthy bones, but also our immune system. And without enough vitamin D, you're more susceptible to infections and cancer. So if there isn't enough sunlight, our body revs up the amount of cholesterol it has to convert more. So you can say in Africa, there's plenty of sun. But since the sun is so strong, they developed darker skin, darker pigmentation. So less sun actually makes its way through the skin.
But there's a trade-off here because paler skin more often leads to melanoma.
Right. So, and it's interesting. Research is now showing the possibility that melanoma, which is the deadlier form of skin cancer as opposed to squamous, that may actually benefit from some sun exposure and vitamin D.
Now, a listener asked why the FDA doesn't do anything about how much iron is added into dry cereal because some of them contain 50% of our daily intake in one serving. Wouldn't that actually be dangerous for people in some conditions?
Right, and I really wish they do because I'm right now passing on the breakfast cereal. Unfortunately, the concept with iron was, you know, the more iron we give out, the better. And the FDA has really should update and open the issue again about fortification of food.
Well, these diseases don't serve a useful purpose anymore in many cases, although there's still malaria. Malaria is a major problem in Africa. I don't know whether that has led to a continuation of sickle cell as a serious problem. But some of these others are no longer with us. Won't they eventually kind of, won't the mutations kind of disappear in time?
Well, it depends on the pressure again. So what the thinking is right now is that the possibility that many of, say, the microorganisms that caused the selection in the first place might be here and might be benign because of the selection advantage of the disease.
Could you put on your headphones? We'll take a couple of calls. Our listeners are calling at 212-433-9692. They're calling to talk to Dr. Sharon Moalem, who has written with the help of Jonathan Prince, Survival of the Sickest, A Medical Maverick Discovers Why We Need Disease. It's published by William Morrow. Before we get to those calls, you're called a medical maverick. Why?
I think because I'm offering a completely new way to look at disease. We've essentially declared war on cancer. We've declared war on heart disease. We declared war without really understanding who the enemy is and how these diseases might have arisen.
Now, why Tay-Sachs disease amongst some Eastern European Jews? Now, that's one that seems to be fairly rare these days.
Right. So the idea is that many genetic diseases that result in a metabolic disorder, what that means is the inside of some cells are dirty, and the house cleaning or the housekeeping system is not working efficiently. So people with two copies of a Tay-Sachs gene, it's not compatible with life. Children, unfortunately, don't live past the age of 5. But if you have one copy, it's thought that possibly it could protect you against bacteria that like to live within your cells, such as TB. So the idea now is that since the rates of TB in these populations, of course, have gone down, there's been selection against Tay-Sachs.
Michael from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I have celiac disease, otherwise known as SPRU or gluten intolerance, which means, you know, I can't eat wheat, the staff of life. And I've never been able to figure out if this is just, you know, an accident or if there's some, as your guest is talking about, evolutionary purpose for it.
Well, do you know where your ancestors are from?
Where my what?
Your ancestors are from? Where your family hails from?
Mostly Northern European.
Okay, so celiac disease is a very interesting condition. Like you said, you know, there's so many common foods that you have to stay away from.
Right.
And many people that keep eating wheat discover that they become anemic.
Right.
So the thinking...
That was how I got diagnosed, actually.
Exactly. So the thinking is that it made people anemic, and that anemia protected people against the plague. And the areas today that have the highest amount of celiac, which is Ireland and Northern Europe, are exactly the same areas that are thought to have suffered the highest losses during the bubonic plague.
Thank you so much for your call. Mary from Westport, Connecticut. Hi, you're on the air.
How are you?
I'm well, and you?
I'm very well. I once heard that there was some genetic advantage to cystic fibrosis, and I've been trying to remember what that advantage might be, and I thought maybe I could be reminded.
Sure. Well, so cystic fibrosis, just to put it out for the listeners there, is a condition where there's a channel in a cell. So imagine like the Panama Canal. So it allows things to come in and out. So in people who have two mutations, that the canal is shut down. So the idea is that it protected people against typhoid fever, because Salmonella typhi, the bacteria that causes it, used that canal to as a backdoor to sneak into the cells.
Okay. Thank you for your call. Tom from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, how are you?
I'm well. I don't have any of these conditions, so I'm doing okay. I guess I have no ancestors.
This is true. Meaning you're okay. That is. So the question I have for you is, I know most mammals, and I'm not sure about most animals, but most mammals synthesize vitamin C. When did we lose the ability to synthesize vitamin C?
No one seems to know the answer to that question. People have looked in other animals, and it seems to be in most mammals, it's us and guinea pigs that don't produce it. And some people have thought that maybe it occurred when we switched to agriculture and we had a really good supply of fresh vegetables that allowed us to have our vitamin C.
Okay, thanks for your call. Jeffrey from Lyndhurst.
Yes. One of the things that you said was that one of the reasons why we may have type 1 diabetes is because with type 1 diabetes, it causes the sugar to go up, which helps prevent damage from freezing.
Yes.
But with type 1 diabetes, it's irreversible because it's an autoimmune disease. So I was wondering, like, how do you go from type 1 diabetes and have it be reversed in frogs or whatever?
Right. So the frog that actually has that diabetes, it reverses every winter. So the idea is that not everyone who suffered from this condition kept it. So possibly that ancient populations also reverted back to a pre-diabetic state.
Thank you for your call. Let's get back to that whole business about you being described as a medical maverick. Does that mean that many of your colleagues, I know you're at Mount Sinai School of Medicine right now, will disagree with you on some of this or all of this?
Definitely. I think, you know, medical science as a society tends to be conservative, and new ideas, you know, take time to take hold. And I always think about the example of Barry Marshall. He came up with the notion that ulcers were infectious, caused by bacteria, and his colleagues and medical practitioners thought he was crazy. Turns out he was right and won the Nobel Prize for it.
So are you angling for a Nobel Prize by suggesting that there's a relationship between evolution and some of the more common diseases?
I think it's very early in my career to be speaking about prizes.
But don't doctors generally assume that in some cases this is true? We mentioned sickle cell anemia, for example. Is it just that they're willing to go along with some but not others?
The problem is that medical practitioners don't really get evolution as part of their curriculum. And this unfortunately bore fruit when doctors were overprescribing antibiotics, which led to their quick resistance. If they would have known just simple evolutionary principles, they might have been much more judicial when handing out antibiotics.
And do you think that we're going to see a new branch of evolutionary science?
Yes, and it's called evolutionary medicine. And the idea is to get evolution into medical school so when people go out to practice medicine, they realize that the nature of and reason for disease have evolutionary origins.
Dr. Sharon Moalem will be giving a talk on Sunday the 25th at the 92nd Street Y. That's at 7:30. For tickets and more information, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. His book is called Survival of the Sickest. A medical maverick discovers why we need disease, or at least we have needed it in the past. And it is published by William Morrow. I want to thank you so much for being with us today. It's been really interesting, and I know it's inspired a lot of people to call in.
Thank you for having me.